I am going to speak about Catholic principles, but it's certainly the case that the Catholic Church thinks of these principles as principles of natural reason, and that therefore they're not only principles that all Christians can use for thinking about public life, but I think all people of goodwill can use these principles to think about public life. There are two dimensions, as I see it, to the Catholic social doctrine or Catholic social teaching. One I would call the limited government side. And here, after the French Revolution, the tremendous growth of the modern nation state, the Catholic Church was very anxious about the absorptive power of the modern nation state. And so the Church identifies the proper autonomy of the family, the rights of parents to educate their children, the liberty of the Church as essential things, rights to be protected in the modern context. And I think you could say that the Catholic Church sees the family below and the church or religious communities above pinioning or limiting the power of the state, that they're living institutions and loyalties that motivate people to keep the state at arm's length, to limit the state's attempt to gain control of everything. And to this, you can add also a Catholic solicitude or concern about nurturing mediating institutions. This was a time period where the church encouraged the formation of Catholic labor unions and sodalities and other forms of Catholic organizations to provide a rich and textured public life. So in short, it seems, or at least as my interpretation of this element of the tradition, the church is concerned that there be a robust, flourishing, and differentiated social life that can resist absorption into politics or absorption into the purposes of the modern nation state. But there's also a second dimension here, because there's a second challenge that Christians faced in the modern era. And this has been a concern about the atomizing and effects of the modern economic practices and various cultural trends. There's a concern about individualism as a dominant tendency, as well as materialism, not necessarily materialism in the narrow sense of a grasping desire for more money, but in the sense of utilitarianism, that the essential goods of public life can be reduced to material well-being and material welfare. So there's these concerns. And I call this the solidarity side of Catholic social teaching. And here you get emphasis on the common good, the universal destination of all goods, and preferential option for the poor, which I see as a reparative element of the Catholic tradition to repair the body politic by always bringing back those who have fallen by the wayside. So those two elements, the limited government side and the solidarity side, are part of this tradition. I think they're part of the political wisdom that Christians should bring to bear on public life. But each political moment is different, and we have to use our reason to try to discern which side of this tradition to give the most emphasis to. And so my submission tonight is that it's the solidarity side of this tradition that is the most important and needs to be highlighted. The reason why, seems to me, is to look at the current political environment. It seems the election of Donald Trump has exposed, I think, political realities that we have to grapple with. One, a borderless world and our global economic system undermines the common good. It's not clear that we can actually use the language of the common good to speak about global realities. I don't think that there is such a thing as a global common good. Common goods require communities united in common loves and loyalties. And so there can be no global solidarity. And so we have to think here, and this is being exposed to us, and we see this in terms of various conversations about protectionism, immigration, and these sorts of matters have to do with this borderless global world that's developing. Second, I think Trump's election exposes that statism is not growing, or statism is not a threat because of socialistic ideological fantasies. Instead, I think, as Alexis de Tocqueville predicted, instead, atomized individuals who have no stable social context to live their lives, atomized individuals call for and demand the minute administration of life by the remote and distant authority of the state. So it seems to me that what we see is that statism is a function of, or the threat of statism emerges as the social and moral order of society declines, and the political order has to move into the vacuum in order to take up the slack. And so, as an aside, in this context, entitlement reform, forget about it. That's an impossible political project in an environment where people are atomized and increasingly culturally and economically insecure. Third point, I think, that we see in the present moment that Trump's election, I think, exposes or reveals to us, and that is that democracy in America is dependent upon a strong middle class. It has, and that we increasingly live in a society where this middle class is economically insecure and culturally demoralized. You know that there's something going on in our political culture when a Republican candidate can speak about makers and takers, and a Democratic candidate can speak about deplorables. So when both parties are saying that 50% of the country is somehow outside the social compact or social contract, you know you've got problems. And I would submit that Trump exposes that since 2000, our political culture has increasingly organized itself around the interests and needs of the top 20% of society. It's really quite telling that places like AEI and Heritage don't have full-time staff working on immigration questions, when in fact it turns out to be the single most salient political issue in the West in the 21st century. I think that's an indication of how much our politics has come to revolve around the interests of the top 20%. As I've said in other contexts, our political culture has become a donorocracy. So the way forward, what is the way forward, it seemed, and I want to look at this. There are two Catholic principles that I haven't mentioned. One is private property, and the other is subsidiarity. And they both strike me as ways to think about how we can navigate forward. Pius XI, when he talks in one of his encyclicals about private property, identifies the fact that it's based in the human desire for self-government. We desire to live self-directed lives. And this means we have to have a place to stand. You can't have a self-directed life if you're treading water in an ocean of infinite flux. So it takes in modern terms, it takes a modicum of property in order to have a basis on which to lead a self-governing life. And it also requires social norms, stable social norms, that provide us with stability, especially in marriage and in domestic life. I would submit that both of those are identified as to lead a self-directed life. So, to go forward, we need to restore a stable place for people to stand, especially for the family, those two principles to limit government, the family below and the church above, the family. So how do we restore property to the 21st century middle class family, which I think that's the single most important political project we need to undertake, which is to restore property to the 21st century middle class family. Property is not the same as income. And I think we do not need guaranteed basic income. Instead, we need a Homestead Act for the 21st century, because the Homestead Act provided people with access to property, not to a monthly check. You don't lead a self-directed life. It's less of a basis for a self-directive life, a monthly check, than having a nut, having some element of wealth on which you can then make decisions about how to lead your life. Another possibility is maybe we need a value-added tax and not an income tax, because income tax is a drag on wealth accumulation, whereas value-added tax gives people an option. They can make sacrifices in consumption in order to accumulate wealth. So it seems to me that it's the middle-class family with family income between $80,000 and $150,000 that ought to be our target for how do we help them accumulate wealth. How do we allow them to actually accumulate property in this classical term? And how do we then also restore, equally important, maybe more important, cultural stability and confidence to the middle class? Certainly one of the most influential books that I read in the last half a dozen years was Charles Murray's Coming Apart, dramatizing what I think many of us sensed but never could put our finger on, which is this dramatic isolation of the top 20% from the rest. In this context, I think the tax on supersized endowments of elite universities is a wonderful thing. It's a minimal tax, but the law is also a teacher, and it sends a clear message to middle-class America that that the people at the very tippy-top have to carry more weight than everyone else. I've also suggested a divorce tax as a way of trying to restore cultural stability, a tax on divorce. I think social conservatives, Christian conservatives, need to establish a litmus test for appointment of judges that they overturn these ridiculous precedents that give pornographers greater constitutional protection than religious believers. This is an insane legal environment, and I think we should make it a litmus test. I think that school standards should have requirements for biblical literacy also. But I'm not a policy wonk, so I don't want to go into territory I'm probably not well-equipped to defend. It seems to me that we've inherited, as conservatives, the limited government side of this Christian Catholic tradition. It's a good tradition. It's a good element. And it's an anti-statist tradition. But I think, and this is a good tradition, but I think we have to face political realities in the 21st century. In the 1930s, Pius XI faced growing totalitarianism in Europe. And he identified subsidiarity, the principle of subsidiarity, as a crucial element. And the principle of subsidiarity is not just that the government get out of the way of local institutions, but also that the government provide the resources and protection to local institutions, especially the family, so that they can flourish. So it's not just hands-off, but it's also, in some instances, hands-on. And as I said, I'm not a policy wonk, but I can see that we have come to the end of an era as conservatives. And I think that era has been one where if we could just get the government out of interfering and messing and undermining the healthy institutions in our society, we would be okay. But I think the night is far gone, and those institutions are pretty disrupted, especially the family. And so it's going to take political initiative on our part to try to, in a tailored, targeted way, to restore solidarity to our society, domestic solidarity, national solidarity as well. And we need to do that in order to restore the basis for a culture of freedom. And I would submit in conclusion then that this is a political project and not simply a spiritual and cultural project. That we have a duty as Christians to enter into the public sphere, to use the power of government to try to restore and reinvigorate the mediating institutions, especially the family, that are necessary in order for us to have a robust culture of freedom and in order for us to be able to limit government over the long term. Thank you.
It's now time for our panel, and I can invite our panelists perhaps to come up and take their places on the stage. Elizabeth Corey will be moderating our discussion. I'm just going to introduce each of these people rather briefly. I'm trusting in their fame and your culture to know exactly all of their qualifications. But Elizabeth Corey is Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the Honors Program at Baylor University. She'll be moderating our discussion. Joshua Mitchell is Professor of Political Theory at Georgetown University. He is formerly the Acting Chancellor of the American University of Iraq, and before that, helped establish Georgetown's School of Foreign Service in Qatar, and has published in the issue of, for example, Alexis de Tocqueville on Religion, Democracy, and the American Future. George Weigel, known to many in the room, of course, as the Distinguished Senior Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, where he holds the William E. Simon Chair in Catholic Studies, the author and editor of many books, the most famous of which I hope everyone in the room has read or will read soon, John Paul II, the biography of John Paul II, Witness to Hope. I can just say, as a personal matter, that affected me very much as a young lawyer here in Washington, D.C., so part of the reason why I'm standing here in a white Dominican habit is because of George Weigel writing about John Paul II. So please do read that book. And so let me hand the conversation off to Elizabeth to continue talking about the stimulating observations of Rusty Urbino.
Great, thank you. What I think we will do by way of procedure is to allow George Weigel and Josh Mitchell, and then I will say a few words, to respond to Rusty's talk, but also to say things that they think might be relevant to this topic. And then we will perhaps have some questions. I may have some questions for them. They may have questions of each other, after which time we will have some time for questions from the audience. So why don't we begin with George?
Thank you all for being here. Thank you, Elizabeth, and thank you. Rusty, as Henry VIII said to his wife, wives, I won't keep you long here. But I do have seven brief points, which is one more than Henry VIII had wives. But let's go through them very quickly. First, the age of Trump, or the age of Obama, Bush, Clinton, Bush, Reagan, Carter, whomever, doesn't modify Christian political principles, which are perennial. Secondly, the first of those principles, which was articulated in the 22nd chapter of Matthew's Gospel, namely the dominical injunction to render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's, establishes the crucial point that if God is God, Caesar is not God. And neither are the heirs of James Madison or Woodrow Wilson. So there is a built-in preference, a preferential option, if you will, for the limited state at the very roots of Christianity's address to public life. And that claim, I think, was extraordinarily important in the political evolution of the West. Third, the modern state, as Rusty indicated, has what seems to be an inexorable drive to extend its reach into more and more social space. Therefore, this subsidiarity principle, which imagines a textured and layered society in which decision-making is kept at the lowest possible level closest to the people directly affected by the decision, commensurate with the common good, remains a crucial principle today. Fourth, the corruption of politics that we see all around us today, especially those of us who live and work here in the swamp, is the cash out of the corruption of our culture. The two can't be disentangled. And to look to the state, or particularly to the federal government, to repair the damage that has been done to society and political culture, creating the solidarity deficit of which Rusty spoke, is to risk putting solidarity in grave tension with subsidiarity, which under the present circumstances seems to me that both of those great principles will be the loser. Fifth, rebuilding what we used to call Republican virtue, small r, and what I'll call in my March 6th Simon lecture here in Washington, to which all of you are most welcome, and you can see the EPPC website for information on that. Rebuilding of Republican virtue and what I'll call then civic patriotism is a task primarily for civil society and especially religious communities, and the overarching or overweening power of the state has to be kept out of the way of that, both in terms of protecting the space of civil society institutions and resisting attempts to create, which our courts have been doing for some time now, a false official anthropology of autonomy in the name of liberty understood as willfulness. If there is a place for what Rusty called in some notes he sent around very helpfully before, remediating government interactions to deal with the solidarity deficit, I suggested in the American context, that's at the state and local level, and my colleague Yuval Levin has explored that in some detail in his book, Fractured Republics. Sixth, for the federal government, there's a different set of issues which never gets talked about in fora like this, but I think we're going to have to think about more and more. Christian political principles include the principle and duty of self-defense, and it's imperative that Christians develop in the 21st century the just war way of thinking to address the new forms of war that are being waged against American democracy today, principally but not solely by Russia. And on that front, I commend Bill Galston's article in today's Wall Street Journal to all of you. Finally, and in the seventh place, I think there is a global solidarity, and it expresses itself and has expressed itself for the past half century in the support of human rights and pro-democracy activists around the world. And those brave men and women are resources for us, as we hope to be resources for them in addressing the crisis of democratic self-governance, which is manifest throughout the Western world today.
Rusty mentioned Tocqueville, and I should confess up front that since 1989, when I first seriously opened the pages of Democracy in America, I knew that that book was going to determine the shape of my life, and it has. And so I want to wrestle with some of the issues Rusty has been raising through the Tocquevillian lens. And so there'll be different kind of language, maybe different concepts, and we'll see where they converge. And I think they do. So let me start with stating the Tocquevillian paradox that he identifies in the second volume of Democracy in America in 1840. And it's the one that Rusty has identified. Namely, you've got the lonely, isolated individual who is coterminous with the powerful state, this bifurcated condition, which Tocqueville describes in the following way. This is his prediction for the future. You tell me if we're not here. I'm trying to imagine under what novel features despotism may appear in the democratic age. In the first place, I see an innumerable multitude of men, alike and equal, constantly circling around the pursuit of petty and banal pleasures with which they glut their souls. Each of them, withdrawn into himself, is almost unaware of the fate of the rest. Mankind for him consists of his children and his personal friends. As for the rest of his fellow citizens, they are near enough, but he does not notice them. He touches them, but feels nothing. He exists in and for himself. Over this kind of man stands an immense protective power, which alone is responsible for securing the enjoyment and watching over his fate. That power is absolute, thoughtful in detail, orderly, provident, and gentle. It would resemble paternal authority if, fatherlike, it tried to prepare its charge for a man's life. But on the contrary, it tries to keep him in perpetual childhood. It likes to see citizens enjoy themselves, provided they think nothing but of nothing but enjoyment. It does not break men's wills, but it softens, bends, and guides it. It seldom enjoins, but it often inhibits actions. It does not destroy anything, but it prevents much from being born. It is not at all tyrannical, but it hinders, restrains, enervates, stifles, and stultifies so much that in the end, a nation is no more than a flock of timid and hardworking animals with the government as its shepherd. Now, Tocqueville came to America and wrote about America in the Jacksonian moment. He even talks about Andrew Jackson. And of course, Jackson is the first populist. And we think of our problem right now as populism. And what I want to suggest to you is that Tocqueville saw some variant of what we're seeing, and he did not call it populism. He didn't really pay much attention to it, because what he thought was the fundamental problem is what Rusty has here identified, this bifurcated existence between loneliness and isolation and the powerful state, on the other hand, which go together. And so my suggestion is we shouldn't use the term populism. In fact, whenever the Democratic Party and the Republican Party so instantaneously agree about anything, we know there's something wrong. They've never agreed about anything for the last 30 years. But they agree that it's populism. And I want to suggest that it's actually very different, that the problem was already anticipated a long time ago in Tocqueville as early as 1840, and I want to give a different name to it. I want to say that our dilemma can be called management society and selfie man. Now, in my view, we've been living with this fantastic experiment since 1989, where we have globalization and identity politics. These two things go together. They're supported, of course, by Google, by Facebook, by Apple, and so many other transnational corporations, which want us to be self-satisfied with our sacrosanct identities while they manage from above. And I think the one thing I'm going to say about Trump here is that while he doesn't connect the dots, he saw many of the dots. And he saw that this was simply not going to work, that people needed more than this, and we needed to have some, use Rusty's language, some home besides a self-enclosed self and then the dreams of globalization. So let me press this. What is necessary for this bifurcated existence to work psychologically? What would happen to happen in the psychic arena so that this fantastic post-1989 experiment, in which we give up being citizens of a particular nation with real natures, real neighbors, generative families, and enduring communities with all that that entails with respect to their mixed legacies, and hand over the keys to our lives to global managers while our own lives become more insulated, more inured against the pain of everyday life, more wretched in proportion as we are self-satisfied with our identities, with our selfie selves. What would need to happen for this to even make sense, Tocqueville explains, is that democratic citizens would have to feel themselves, and now I'm quoting him, either greater than kings or less than men. And I think that's where we are. In our selfie self lives, we're greater than kings. Through our identities, after all, we have the true source of sovereignty. On the other hand, with respect to communal actions necessary to build a world, we are less than men and happily hand over the keys to global elites. Thus, the predictable strangeness of the response to Trump's withdrawal from the Paris Accords. The planet is doomed because Trump is denying our global managers their right and their capacity to, quote, save the planet. Only in this moment of management society and selfie man is this even thinkable. One can dimly imagine a Tocquevillian alternative. Let's get together with our local and national communities and be stewards of the earth. If we're harming the created world, we, not the global managers, need to address it together. In light of this deep psychic problem, this paradox I think Tocqueville identifies, in which we feel ourselves greater than kings and less than men, what is to be done? And here I fix on Rusty's claim, no doubt controversial to some here in the room, that our problem may require the state to take action where necessary to support and renew the proper power of social institutions and authorities. I do think that, properly understood, state action as a supplement to the institutions of society, but not as a substitute for them, can work, and that it probably should be tried. I do not think, however, that even in this proper use of state power, this can even work until such time as democratic citizens, exhausted from oscillating between the highs of being a sovereign selfie self to the lows of being an impotent cog directed by management society, say enough. This is a bipolar life that we're living. This is the experiment we've been doing since 1989. Tocqueville saw the beginnings of this already in 1840. And he said, we can only truly build a world with our neighbors. Hence the epithet that could stand for the whole of Tocqueville's democracy in America. Feelings and ideas are renewed, the heart enlarged, and the understanding developed only by the reciprocal action of men one upon another. I do think that we're witnessing the beginnings of a return to the sane sentiment that we can only build a world with neighbors. Facebook friends can only be friends if we know what friendship is already. I wonder increasingly if online shopping can work unless we already know what shopping is. Friendship and shopping begin immediately around us. In his haste to overcome his limits, Tocqueville thought democratic man is seldom satisfied with such limitations. Yet to the question, how is this all working for us, the answer increasingly is, it's not. I take the growing Facebook fatigue as a good indicator of the awareness that we have lost sight of what we truly need, which is concrete existence in real, not virtual, communities. I'm not sure that this emerging sentiment will come to prevail, but I do think that Rusty is certainly right when he concludes that we will only be able to have limited government if we restore solidarity. That is, only after we have restored human life on a human scale and face-to-face relations will it be self-evident that the state, important as it surely is as a supplement, could supplement the institutional work of society, but not, as the progressives have long advocated, be a substitute for them. Finally, and I think I signed more with George on this one, the implication of this is that the real work can't be done politically. That the real existential challenge to us is not even at the level of doctrine. It is at the psychic level where we live, and where we live is in this bifurcated place where we're self-enclosed in our own little hermetically sealed worlds, and we look at the global world from afar, but we have no engagement in the face-to-face intermediary associations. So until we get over the psychic arrangement of management man, the management society and selfie man, I don't think we go anywhere. I'll stop.
Well, I have just a few rather informal comments to make. I was thinking about this topic on the way to D.C. this morning. I came up from Texas. And a lot of what I will say will echo things, especially that George and Josh have just said. And it seems to me that really Trump is offering us no categorically new set of circumstances for a Christian. I think it's true, and we all would agree, that his vulgarity is often unmatched. But politics has always been a kind of vulgar business. And it's a realm that is wholly earthly and so more or less corrupt in itself. And so if we're looking to politics for fulfillment, I think we're looking in the wrong place. And this would explain some of what we've been remarking upon about progressives and the desire for fulfillment, if it is totally an earthly fulfillment. Trump offers a very big bar to that for them, and I think that's part of the reason they're in so much despair. But what I would want to highlight here is an old insight, not at all original to me, and it's one that both George especially has mentioned, that the work of culture, learning, and the life of church and family are where we do find our most meaningful life. It's the face-to-face life you're talking about just a moment ago, not politics. Now, I would qualify that by saying I do think there's a place for politics, albeit for most of us it won't be national-level politics. There's a lot of politics that goes on in a university, in a community, in a small community, and it is there that we can engage in politics, I think, that is quite fulfilling and actually does good for us, in the sense that we are interacting with people who are very different from us. I'm on a committee with a woman. I'm a pro-life conservative. She's a very pro-choice Democrat. We have to work together. And I can't write her off as an extremist. She can't do that for me either. And so it's that at these local levels of politics that we actually are forced to temper ourselves and to get along with these people that we probably on a Facebook page wouldn't like at all. So we have the possibility of being efficacious in ways that matter to us in these local and smaller political units, and we're checked by knowing the people that we interact with. So I think this leads to a kind of moderation in our dealings with people at these lower, more human levels. Even if we are hurt or angry, we don't like what they're telling us, we don't like what they're saying, but we have to accommodate ourselves. I want to just give a brief story of what this looks like for me. I was on I have an Airbnb that I rent out behind my home, and the city had started to step in and regulate this Airbnb, and they had required that I pay taxes on it. I said, that's fine. And then they came back and they said, well, you need to be paying back taxes on it. For all the years, we didn't even know you had an Airbnb, but we'd like that money now. And I and some other friends said to the city, well, you know, that doesn't seem fair to us. And they said, well, I'm sorry, you're going to have to pay these taxes. My immediate thought was to organize a kind of protest, take it to the paper, be an adversary to these people. And I had to fight, I had to think it through for a long time before I realized, you know what, that is actually not a very Christian way of proceeding here. I ought to assume that the people on the other end of this dispute are human beings too. So instead of organizing the protest, bringing the paper into it, we wrote a letter. And I'm happy to say it worked. But I think this is what you're talking about with that, with the atomized individuals. The only way to effect a change is to organize a massive protest. No, it isn't. It is actually to engage people in a humane way. Let me make just one other small point about politics and the way a Christian, I think, ought to be oriented in politics. This one I owe to my husband, who is a theorist of the just war. And we often talk about this at home, and he says, and he has told me, if you're going to think about war, you've got to think of the three conditions for a just war: sovereign authority, just cause, and rightful intent. But we've recently realized that these, maybe not the sovereign authority or the just cause, but certainly the rightful intent applies to us insofar as we are engaging in the culture wars. Because it's very easy, as we all know, to begin to see our opponent as an enemy and to be angry at that person and to wish for harm to that person, especially if that person has harmed us first. But the requirement of a rightful intent means that you wish for the good of the person that you are hopefully not waging war with, but having a conflict with. And I think that's something very important for Christians to bear in mind. It's not all out war. It should aim at peace. And there's a way in which we violate the most central Christian principles of love if we view our enemies as enemies and not as fellow travelers. I would like to open this up so that the panel can talk. I have an initial question that I might present, which has come out quite naturally, and it's the question of to what degree the state ought to somewhat less friendly to the idea that the state has any part. Rusty seems more positive toward it. Does anyone want to speak to that issue?
I think the state has a part in providing a legal framework in which that can take place. But right now, for example, on the abortion issue, we are not permitted to act in solidarity with women in crisis pregnancies under certain circumstances. I mean, these clinic boundary rulings and whatnot. The attempt to dragoon by coercive state power into Obamacare's contraceptive and abortifacient mandate, sweet little nuns up on Harewood Road who just want to serve old people, I mean, that had to be resisted. Because that was another encroachment on solidarity. These women were being told, no, you cannot serve others the way you believe you are religiously called to do if you don't truckle to what we, the Uber state, decide you can do. So I think we need to get the legal framework for solidarity reordered. And there may be things that can be done at the state and local level of the sort that Yuval describes in his book. But I've spent 35 years in this city, and to look to the federal government at this moment as a promoter of the virtue of solidarity does not seem to me to be terribly plausible.
Yeah, I think it's a disagreement that George and I have. Obviously, one should be deeply skeptical about the actions of something so mammoth as the federal government. But progressive taxation is a profound policy to encourage solidarity because it uses the power of government to force the winners to pay more and the losers. And, you know, progressive income tax came to Great Britain after World War I as explicitly justified or it was explicitly promoted because some people stayed back, made a lot of money, and a lot of people died. And the feeling was, well, the people who benefited need to pay more than the people who don't. So if we got, I mean, this is an act that we've collectively agreed upon as a nation, progressive taxation. So we do all these things to promote solidarity in our society. So I'm only suggesting that we revisit them and ask, what, given our current social problems, can we do in order to try to repair, especially the solidarity of domestic life, so that people can be faithful to each other in their family life, which is what they want to do, although they often fail miserably, but they want to. People do not get married in order to get divorced. People get married in hopes of it being permanent, and sadly, it often isn't. You know, I find it very amusing that people at AEI are very convinced that taxes can have a dramatic influence on people's behavior in the workplace, but they immediately deny that a tax can have a behavior on other aspects of their lives. So why don't we tax divorce? A progressive tax on divorce, so that if your net worth of the couple is over $500,000, they have to pay 20% to the state to get divorced. We tax cigarettes because it is socially harmful. We know that divorce is socially harmful. Why aren't we taxing divorce? And I mean, I think that's a state-based thing. I don't think the federal government should tax divorce, but because I think these kinds of matters ought to be handled at the state level. But we need to really think seriously, what can we do politically to try to repair the body politic? Because these institutions are so degraded that they're not going to just recover. I mean, human nature is on our side, to be sure, but I think we owe it to our fellow citizens to use in our political action to try to do the things that will encourage and encourage the renewal of these social institutions, especially the family.
Let me step out on this. I think conservatives have used a deeply impoverished language for the last 40 years. The terms of engagement are big government or small government. And I think this is just a terrible confusion. We'll use Tocqueville. His view is, and I think the three of us agree on this, that it's in the institutions of society where civilized human beings are built, and that's the family, that's civic associations, that would preferably be local government, and that would be in our churches and synagogues, full stop. And then the question becomes, what's the proper relationship between state and society? And little government conservatives say, well, no, it's got to stay out. And meanwhile, these institutions, as Rusty points out, are all hemorrhaging. We all know they're hemorrhaging. So does that mean we have to move from little government to big government? No, I don't think that's the right way to look at it. What we have to understand, and I said this in my remarks very briefly, is that we have to distinguish between supplement and substitute. The state can supplement. The state can do certain things. I think that when Kennedy put the troops in University of Alabama, I think that was actually a good thing. Now, maybe it went too far. Maybe we tried to solve the crisis of the African-American community by, rather than using government as a supplement, we turned it into a substitute for the community. And so, as William Raspberry used to write in the 1980s, we've decimated the African-American community. But I think rather than big and small government, I think theoretically, we can begin to have a conversation without gasping when Rusty says what he says by saying, let's think of society as the mother load, and the state can supplement for the institutions of society periodically when things are deeply dysfunctional, but it can never be a substitute. And that's the progressive project. So I think if we turn away from big and small and think in terms of supplement and substitute, we've got a way to go forward here.
Yes, you made me think of another question that came up in relation to what George had said. You made the comment that solidarity is in tension with subsidiarity. And I wonder what you meant by that, and if you could say a little more about that.
Well, I think what I meant to say was that if we look state as the primary actor in repairing the solidarity deficit, then that is to put solidarity in tension with subsidiarity, which asks us, at least as I understand the subsidiarity principle, to look first to civil society and then to some civil society state mix, perhaps of the sort that Joshua is describing as supplement, but don't start with the state as the fixer here. I'd like to ask Rusty, first of all, it's probably worth mentioning in a Catholic context here, that the income tax was adopted by the federal government because of Prohibition. The 16th and 18th
what, to overcome amendments the loss of
exactly, to revenue. Overcome the loss of revenue from excise taxes. This is all in Dan Okrent's wonderful book on the history of Prohibition, which we all know, of course, was a Protestant heresy imposed on the United States, which I am voluntarily imposing on myself for the next 6 weeks of Lent. income tax versus value-added tax, how does value-added tax not hurt the losers in the globalization game?
No, that's a great question. It obviously hurts people in the bottom third. But I think that from a political theoretical level, the great threat to democracy is in 2018 is a global oligarchy. We already have a very powerful oligarchy in the United States. As I said, I think our political priorities have shifted to the interests of the top 20% pretty strongly in the last 20 years. I think identity politics is a rich person's preoccupation. And obviously, top marginal tax rates is a rich person's preoccupation. And both parties, before Trump, had become very decadent in those two preoccupations. I mean, gay marriage is the ultimate sort of 1% issue. So I think in this context, to restrain oligarchy, you need to have a confident middle class that keeps the rich in line, and in order to have a democracy, functional democracy. I think it's as simple as that. And so we have to focus on how we can get families of incomes between $80,000 and $200,000 to become culturally confident and economically secure, so that they feel like, hey, you know, you poor people, you're not working hard enough. So that's what it used to be like. Middle class people tutted to people who were lazy at the bottom of the social scale, and then they criticized the people at the top of the social scale. So by the time you get to 1955, we have this, middle class nation where everybody claims to be middle class. And John Kenneth Galbraith writes a book about the poor, and people are shocked to discover that, wow, there's still poor people in America. And we invent a category called the upper middle class to describe rich people who don't want to think of themselves as rich, but as part of the middle class. That's why we had such a harmonious political culture, because both parties competed to serve the interests of the middle class and accused the other one of not. Welfare queens on the one side, the fat cat Republican Party on the other side. But it's really changed quite a bit in the last 20 years. And so I think we have to think policy-wise, in the large picture, how do we get not the bottom 30%, we should care about them, we should do our best to try to make their lives better, and certainly not the top 20% winners in the global economy. It's the people between the bottom, what Charles Murray says, the people in the bottom, people in the top. It's the people in the middle, actually, who are driving our political instability in the country right now.
I guess another distinction I would like to make now, or offer now, and maybe Josh wants to comment on this. You talk about management society and selfie man. How about the problem of selfie man versus responsible man? Selfie man who imagines freedom simply as the exercise of willful autonomy.
Yeah.
And responsible man who has what I believe is a much more humanistic understanding of freedom as doing what is objectively right, which we can know by reason, and doing that as a matter of habit, and having the liberty to do that, to pursue nobility, as best we can. I mean, this seems to me to be a huge problem right now. And I don't see any way of fixing that, short of what I called last year, some form of new Great Awakening. That may not be entirely religious in character, that may involve secular people who are deeply worried about the loss of the fundamental truths on which the American democratic experiment is based. But unless there is some sort of moral cultural revival here, it seems to me that none of this is going to get addressed in a serious way. And at the root of that moral cultural revival has to be the restoration of a nobler idea of freedom.
Well, two things. First of all, the way I put it, we are right now in the moment of a third great awakening without religion. And what I mean by that is everywhere we look, and this is the left's identity politics, it's all about guilt and fault in the Me Too movement too. The men who are doing onerous things, yes, they have to be prosecuted. I get all that. But we're in the midst of a guilt and debt crisis. And while I'm not a fan of Nietzsche, I think he did get this right, which is the crisis of the West would be that we would retain some of the accoutrements of Christianity, like guilt and debt and fault, but would no longer have the religious architecture on the basis of which it could be processed. And I think this is, you know, you look at the immigration crisis in Europe, they have debt, they have this sense of fault for whether it's World War I, World War II, colonialism. So they are in the midst of a crisis of guilt and fault, but they have no religious architecture to do it. That's the first thing. Second thing, so Elizabeth had mentioned that, and this is to your point, George, the second point, that we've got political activism. Political activism is the Facebook selfie man's idea of politics. It's you go do something for a minute, and then you step back. And Elizabeth gave the story of how she's working with somebody on the other side of the political spectrum. And the thing is, the only way to attenuate these incredible polarizations in society is when you have to literally work with someone, when you have to depend on someone, your neighbor who's different than you. I'm the president of a homeowners association. It's profoundly dysfunctional. Profoundly dysfunctional. Far left, far right. But we have to make sure that the ponds get cleared and this kind of stuff. And that's the only way forward. So we have to develop something beyond selfie man and political activism, and that can only happen when we have embodied communities where people literally have to count on each other. But we've moved from a political organization or orientation based on democracy, broadly understood, which is to say we get together, we talk about things, and we solve problems of the local community, to a regime of rights, where the state gives you rights, and that's all you really need. You just need to have the assurance that the state's going to back you up, and so you can go off and be crazy in your direction, and somebody else can go off and be crazy in their direction, because we don't need each other. And that's why I said, I don't think we're going to get anywhere until we take a good, hard look at our lives and say, this bifurcated existence, where we are wholly self-satisfied with ourselves, but basically believe we're incapable of democracy, of actually building a world together, is if we don't get past that, we can talk and talk and talk till we're blue in the face. I'm saying we're living this disease right now. There's a global disease. It's a psychic crisis. And this is how we're living. And Tocqueville saw this in 1840. And if we can't come to the conclusion that we need more than political activism, we need more than self-enclosed human beings who dream of some romantic global whole, if we can't get past that, we are doomed. And we'll have exactly the picture of late democratic age that I read to you at the beginning. That's what we will have. And so the real battle, I want to say, yes, it's political, but the anterior battle is in our own heads. And I think we're losing it right now.
Well, you know, I think one reason that certainly in Europe it's more pronounced than the United States, but certainly a nationalist move reflects the fact that people don't actually want to live as selfies. They want to
have a home.
They want to feel themselves to be part of a whole, where they actually need each other. Now, the problem with that is that it's quite remote, and it's very notional.
And so it's the nation.
We experience patriotic emotions quite strongly, but I'm 58 years old, so the idea that my country's going to call upon me to make a sacrifice is now not really realistic. So it's a very cheap way to express solidarity and loyalty. because the likelihood somebody's going to call my pledge due is very low. Family and local community, but especially family, is, I think, the primary way most people learn how to be citizens of a... They learn how to be citizens. They learn how to serve a common good. They learn there are some things that we can only have together. We can't have them alone. Because you can't take a marriage... When divorced, you can't take the marriage and divide it in half and say, you get half of the good of marriage and you get the other half of the good of marriage. You can only have the good of marriage if you stay married. Or you can only have the good of family if you remain together. And, you know, often family members have those different political views, and, you know, Thanksgiving and these things can be, you know, delicate. But it's good. It's part of how we learn how to be citizens of some, not in a simply self-projected world. And I think part of, that's why, you know, I'm a kind of Johnny One Note, that, you know, taking prudent political measures to try to nudge people towards sustaining their marriages, entering into them in the first place, sustaining them, and giving people resources to try to do their best, given the cultural deformations that we're all subject to, would be a very, very useful and important political move to make, precisely to help us overcome, which is the deeper spiritual kind of insanity that we're living in.
Yeah, and I hope that's right. My worry is that the disease is so deep. You know, Plato, I'm just teaching Plato right now, and Plato...
Oh, you're sort of an optimist?
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the paradoxes in Plato is that, you know, if you're really a sick soul, the thing that you most need is the thing you're not going to want. And so if this disease has metastasized to this level, I'm just worried. And I agree with you. We need to have all those things. But I see this dim longing for home. But my worry is that after globalization, and you just said this, the form of home that we're going to get is a kind of romanticized nationalism. I think this is especially going to be the case in Europe. This is incredibly dangerous. And so I think we could have less of this problem in America precisely because the only thing that can attenuate this enchanted nationalism is a political arrangement in which we have to deal with each other face to face. Nothing stops the disenchanted thoughts in your mind more quickly than having to look over at your neighbor and realizing, oh no, this is not going to happen. So So I think after globalism, there's two distinct possibilities: ethnic nationalism, and we're going to see this in Europe, and then liberalism in the best possible sense, a federal liberalism where we actually have to build face to face. And I think all the subsidiarity stuff can fit within that, and that's what we have to aim for. So I'd be more inclined to push toward federalism first, rather than the state stepping in, because I just don't see that the state has any interest whatsoever in this. It has every interest in making sure there's a proliferation of rights over which it can watch. Every interest in expanding its power. Every interest in maintaining this bifurcated place where you and I are completely isolated. A tyrant will forgive citizens for not loving him, provided they do not love each other, Tocqueville says. So the state, I don't see, has any real interest in this. It's just growing in leaps and bounds, and the corollary is the lonely, isolated self.
Well, we do have a history. I mean, you've got tax exemptions for charitable organizations, and so we do have a political tradition of solicitude for these mediating institutions and the associations that we form to function as civic agents and not as isolated individuals. So, you know, why your pessimism that we can't? I mean, we live in a different time, and we're going to have to find our way forward to figure out, well, what are the political instruments? A tax-exempt status was not delivered from Mount Sinai. It had to be thought through as to what to do as we began to move from excise taxes to various corporate taxes and individual income taxes. And people thought it through, and they said, well, we want our tax system to encourage, not just to permit, but to encourage certain kind of behavior. And we've done that. We obviously have to protect it, continue to protect it, but maybe we need to explore, well, is there some kind of cognate way we can encourage family life through tax policy and through other proper instruments of government, and not coercive ones.
You know, one example of this constant atomization that I think could be easily reversed is the restoration of the notion of voting day. Mm. It is profoundly dissolving of the civic community to have early voting, mail-in voting.
I agree.
All of this nonsense that has, I would even say, multi-language ballots. I mean, and a great old Hubert Humphrey Democrat in this town said to me 30 years ago, I do not understand why the ballot is in 13 languages in San Francisco. I mean, that means there is no civic conversation. And if you can't read a ballot in English, you are not part of the mainstream conversation. Put the language issue aside. It seems to me it's a very easy to do symbolic gesture that this is a political community, not simply a gang of monads banging around on the political pool table here, to restore the notion that there is one voting day and we all vote the same day. We don't, and we let the argument continue until voting day, which is now truncated by these absurd early voting things, which simply assume that everybody knows what they think anyway. They have no responsibility to listen to anybody else. There's a simple thing to do, it seems to me, that the state could do to restore at least some minimal measure of civic community.
Let me jump in here and be slightly more optimistic than some of us have been over the last few minutes. I teach at Baylor, and I teach undergraduates only, usually freshmen and sophomores. And what I see in them, though, is not so hopeless, because they are intensely concerned with things like what kind of families they're going to have, who they will marry, what their life will look like. I mean, I do think that this atomization, they've grown up with it. They've been on Facebook their entire teenage lives, I suppose. And they're beginning to see the limits of this, and so they're asking, well, what else is there? How might I orient my life in a way that is not like this? So I do think, and I'm seeing a lot of college students here, some of whom I know, and they're asking these questions. So it's not as if our only choice is atomization or no political engagement. They're going to ask these questions. I also think that we have regionally very many examples of places where people have dug in and said, I'm going to stay here. Texas is one of those, for good or ill. I mean, whenever I travel, people are like, Texas, or Texas is great. But people have an identity there, and they understand themselves to be part of a community that is, it's a state, but then within Texas, you've got these smaller
republic.
Cities. What's that?
Not a state, it's a republic.
Right, of course. And that is true in other places, too. I'm from South Louisiana. They had it there. Everyone has a real sense that there is a community, there's a way of life, there are traditions, there are things we do. And I think increasingly people are drawn to that kind of life, and they make conscious decisions to move and be in those places. And that is a sign of hope.
Can I say one more thing? So I'm now teaching freshmen at Georgetown this year. I teach every year. But I will say something is changing. I agree with you. The this year's class, there's generational shifts. There's something happening with the youngest ones. They know that there's something wrong with the way they've been living. They're desperately searching for language. Look, I don't want to sound like I'm the pessimist. My fundamental point here is that I agree with Rusty that the state can and should do things like this. My concern is what happens in the minds of people before we get to that. And my worry is that in the minds of people right now, we're satisfied with this bifurcated existence. And this is not me. This is Tocqueville saw this in 1840. And my view is that if we can awaken to the fact that this is deeply unstable, then there's some hope. And some people are doing this. But I walked over here, and everybody in Washington is looking at their cell phone as they're walking. This is a problem. I routinely teach a lecture called Facebook is Death. And I mean this. So I think there are some hopeful signs, but it takes the form of, I know there's something wrong, let me check my cell phone. And that's, I think, where we are. So I'm saying that all this stuff that Rusty wants, I agree with it, but it's not going to happen until something happens in our minds and we say, this bifurcated existence, where we don't have an engaged, real, concrete life with others in face-to-face relationships. Until people say, I gotta have it, we're not gonna make forward progress. So I'm saying the psychic thing has to really happen first. You can win the battle by doing government programs, but you can't win the war. And I'm concerned with winning the war.
We have time for a few questions from the audience.
John Solid, I'm an economist. Globalization has been responsible, many would say, including myself, for a significant reduction in world poverty, increased living standards throughout the world. And standards of living even in this country have also increased. So my question is, are you not picking an inappropriate target to criticize when it's really maybe a social cohesion issue that might be affected or might be have been caused by social issues, the pill, feminization. So there could be a whole thing that's going on, and that there's a danger, then I'll shut up, but that if we close up, we reduce international cooperation, social cooperation on an international scale, which is, I would say, a common good, a global common good. So any thoughts?
Yeah, I don't think there is a global common good. There has to be something, economic growth creates things that can be parceled out, and common goods can't be parceled out. Now, peace and lack of violence is a kind of negative good. To be cherished. but your point, I think, is an important one. And it's my view that the global economic system is increasingly losing support among voters in the West. And that some of that is misconceived in terms of what its real implications are. And some of it's probably it's correct in terms of how the changes since 1989 have reallocated winners and who are the winners and who are the losers in the West, in the rich world. And so that as leaders, I think we should want to preserve this global system, but it won't survive a loss of political legitimacy in the West. So if the rich West politically, if populism in the rich West is successful, we won't be able to sustain the global system. Or it'll fall into the hands of the Chinese, in which case it really won't be the kind of system that'll be even remotely congenial to the things that we deeply care about, and not just national things, but human things we deeply care about. So I think we need to adjust and make the adjustments that are necessary in order to renew political support from the middle class so that they'll support the global system that I think, I agree, basically is good for tens of millions of people throughout the world.
Yes, thank you. This has been a great program. I just have two questions. One, I guess, to Rusty first. Your focus on the upper middle class, the 80,000 to 200,000. I wonder why you're focusing on that. You did make a reference that, yes, we have to look at the lower income, and the average income is 50,000.
Average family?
The average family, I think, is 50. Who's the economist in the audience? May know that. But it's the 80 to 100. I mean, the ones that voted for Trump were the live paycheck to paycheck and so forth. So what I'm getting at is, shouldn't the focus be getting that group into the upper middle class? And I'm not sure what you meant by a Homestead Act in terms of an example. My second question is a different one related probably to anybody in the panel in terms of the role of religious leaders interacting with political leaders. I'm thinking, of course, of the strong evangelical support of President Trump, despite his tabloid conduct background that everybody is aware of. And I'm recalling Tony Perkins' comment the other day when he said about Trump's conduct and the relationship, where he said, well, we'll give him a mulligan. Now, President John F. Kennedy, our first and only Catholic president, was no saint either. But at least it wasn't in the public. So I'm just trying to get an idea of what that kind of interaction should be. Are they being hypocritical about that, or should they say, well, we're utilitarian, we're going to get something else if we play nice to this president? So those are the two questions. Thank you.
Right. I think I traveled around and spoke at some evangelical churches and ahead of the election, and there was a palpable sense of existential dread at the prospect of Hillary Clinton's election. And they felt that they would, that their way of life was going to be targeted, and that they were on the cusp of persecution. And so I think that explains this overwhelming evangelical support for Trump. He's a bad man, but he's going to protect me. I think that's a simple explanation. Now, the irresponsibility of evangelical leaders they're irresponsible not to hold him accountable for a lot of his more outrageous and grotesque behavior since his election. I agree. That is irresponsible on the part of many evangelical leaders, although some have spoken up quite... Russ Moore, I think, has been very courageous in speaking up about this. But I think obviously we should try to encourage the poor to become middle class, but I think one of the, and I'm not so much worried about the paycheck to paycheck folks who voted for Trump so much as, get college students, right, whose economic prospects are actually pretty darn good. I mean, we're looking at, even before the election, I mean, unemployment rates for college-educated people were pretty darn low. But they flocked to Bernie Sanders, and so there's this sense of insecurity that seems to want to, it wants the state to provide the security. And I think I want limited government. I don't want the all-powerful nanny state. And I think in order to deter that or prevent that, we have to do what we can. We can't create it. That's the kind of progressive myth that we can kind of create social realities. But we have to try to do what we can to try to encourage this kind of confidence. Again, it's a cultural confidence. Your point, there's all kinds of cultural factors. There's an element of cultural confidence here. I mean, you think about it, creators, the creative class, innovators, all these terms that I used in a very positive way in the aughts and into the early teens are really basically only applied to a tiny percent of the population. So we spent all this time politically celebrating the people at the very tippy top. They're the engine that's pulling the train forward. Without them, we got to get H-1B visas because there aren't enough, they're like super smart computer programmers. And the messaging we're giving is that if you're a UPS truck driver, you make a pretty decent living. We don't need you. And I think that this is part of the corrosive civic culture that's emerged in the last decade that we need to address.
Just a few, very few thoughts. First of all, I think it's always important to distinguish between the mainstream media identified evangelical leadership and the real evangelical leadership. Trump may have succeeded in killing the former because the foolishness coming out of the bowels of Franklin Graham, may his father who died today rest in peace, Falwell the less, and Tony Perkins, I think just reveals the hollowness of people who value proximity to power, which they imagine foolishly that they're somehow manipulating over principle. And that may kill this and allow real leaders like Russell Moore and others to emerge. That having been said, one of the things that occurred to me when I think for probably everybody in the room, was reading J.D. Vance's book a couple of years ago, was what a colossal failure of the churches is revealed in that book. Here are people whose parents, grandparents, great-grandparents were all part of evangelical Protestant communities. And those communities simply dissolved. And this phenomenon that Mr. Vance calls learned helplessness is something that the religious communities ought to have been able to address. And my gang, the Catholic world, was equally at fault for not seeing a great opportunity and trying to help address that. So there was a huge default in the American religious community that has created this enemy that now expresses itself in the opioid crisis and all the rest of it. And finally, I think to get back to Josh's point about what's inside our heads, we all need a civic conversation about character and public life. I do believe I will make a kind comment about Martin Luther on the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, that he did have it right when he said he'd rather be ruled by a wise Turk than a foolish Christian. There is an element of political wisdom in that. But the notion that character does not count, or even worse, that you can imagine the transfer of character from that which is appropriate to a reality TV show to that which is appropriate to the successor of George Washington suggests some real problems. And we need to get back to this again, not in this conversation about character again, not in a puritanical way, but in a understanding that the way people conduct themselves with others will tell you something about how they're going to conduct themselves as public officials. This just seems to be so obvious, and yet it's very difficult to talk about.
Thank you. I would ask you to comment on the racial divide and what that has caused or what it has contributed here, because the church is guilty of many things, and I think not healing a racial divide. As I look around, we're all white, not all, but maybe 99%, and you haven't addressed that in the thinking. And when you talk about the evangelical supporting Trump, the white evangelical support Trump. The minorities have not. So there's a divide there that I agree that narcissism plays a big role in what's going on in the world, but how do we get the community together when we're still separated white from minority?
Let me take a stab at that. So Rusty's mentioned the term commercial middle-class republic. And my view is, forgetting foreign policy for a minute, the other great thing that we have to address as a nation is the racial wound. And I don't have a generous reading of Black Lives Matter, but I will say this. It is curious that they went after the Democrats. Why? Now, my most generous reading of this, which I don't think is fully warranted if you go to the website and look at what they declare, but my most generous reading of this is that that the identity politics which has been foisted upon the whole country, blacks and every other non-white male heterosexual, that's the offending party, okay? That identity politics basically allocates debt points, victim points, guilt points, based on your proximity to that. And my view is that, not mine alone, that the single wound that we have to heal is a consequence of 200 years of legalized slavery, full stop. And I think Republicans have completely lost an opportunity on this. I think enterprise zones, Jack Kemp, Reagan, I don't think it's not enough. Because it's back to George's point. If the religion doesn't form character in the right way, there's no possible way people who are given jobs will even be able to hold the jobs. So my argument increasingly is that identity politics on the left is a betrayal of Martin Luther King. Because Martin Luther King understood that, yes, there's fault and debt. Two things. Yes, there is fault and debt, but it can't wholly be understood in terms of a worldly set of relations. That's why the churches also have to address it. So yes, there's a literal wound between black and white, but it can only be resolved through the mystery of repentance and forgiveness. So this is a spiritual thing. And I think Martin Luther King understood this. And I think what the Democrat Party did in betraying him was two things. One, forget the spiritual message. So they say to African Americans, come on, join in. But that church thing, that God thing, no, we're not going to, that's not allowed. And I see this with my students at Georgetown. The black students, I know they're religious, but they cannot say that. But the real pathology then is that debt is only understood as a political thing, which, of course, the Democratic Party is going to rub in everybody's noses. Right? They're the ones who are going to allocate guilt and innocence points. And in the African-American community, and I put this in print, but they refuse. They're literally asked to step to the back of the bus so that they can be one identity group among all the others. And they're not. My father's family came over from Lebanon in 1890. Immigrant. My view is that, and I'm in print in saying this, every immigrant should stand in line. Because the only real wound that we have in America that we've got to pay attention to is the slavery wound. Full stop. Now, the way to do that is not simply more federal funding. The state can supplement, but it cannot substitute. And here I think the real work, and Mark Tooley and I and others are working on this, is to bring black and white ministers together, try and renew the covenantal language of Martin Luther King. This must be done, because the silence in the Conservative Party about this is deafening. And the thing is, identity politics has betrayed the African-American community. African-American is not one identity among others. It's just not, because of what they endured. So there's a deep wound in America that has to be healed. The government can't be a substitute for the wound, for the healing action of the church, but it can periodically supplement in some ways. So yes, this has been a blind spot among conservatives, and it's terrible. And the thing is, the African-American community, aside from the few percent that have really benefited from this, they're in the same condition they were in the 1960s and 50s. It's deplorable.
I think it's important to sort of try to think how did it come to pass that racial rhetoric has become so much more fraught and toxic than it was before the Obama presidency. So I just think this testifies to a lot of what Josh is saying about the, like, people are so on edge. And I'm not sure I quite grasp why that's the case. I mean, young people think that discrimination against African Americans is worse now than it has been in the past. Now, young people don't know anything about the past. But that's kind of, we talk about fake news. Wow. I mean, not to say that there aren't legitimate concerns the African-American community has, but, you know, I grew up in Baltimore in the 1960s, and man, it was a lot harder to be a black American in Baltimore in the 1960s than it is today, at least in terms of white racism. So there's something going on. And I don't know what it is. And Josh, maybe you've probed this with this notion. We almost need the guilt. We want the guilt. It seems to give us a kind of spiritual charge.
Pause with that just a minute. I mean, I grew up in Baltimore in the 50s and 60s. And I assure you, it is far worse now.
Not as a consequence of white racism.
No, as a consequence of the absolute self-immolation of the black family.
But these are young people who think that African Americans suffer from more discrimination now.
I understand. I just understand that ignorance. I mean, I experience this all over the world. I have to teach young Poles their own modern history in Poland every summer. Here is another awakening moment. The degree to which the African American church has aligned itself with the deconstructive forces in that community is something that really has to be addressed in a very frank conversation of the sort that I'm glad to hear Josh is involved in, as well as the acquiescence of the black political leadership in the Roe versus Wade license. Yeah. But I mean, we all run into these kids with Planned Parenthood petitions on the street around here. A year ago, I ran into a young African-American woman who was, you know, being paid by Planned Parenthood to get people to sign something. And I tried to engage her, and I said, do you know why African-Americans are now the second largest minority group in the United States? Why Hispanics are now larger? I said, because of what you are supporting here. The decimation of your community by the abortion license, by an institution, Planned Parenthood, that began with an explicitly eugenic agenda. I mean, this is massive self-destruction here. And it has something to do with all of the wounds that Josh is talking about. But I suppose it's going to be a real test of whether the kind of deep civic conversation that all of us are calling for is possible, as to whether within the church communities we can come together as white and African-American Americans and talk about these things in an open and candid way.
Yeah, I mean, all the rhetoric around race has become so toxic that I am not very hopeful about any kind of face-to-face discussion, certainly not about the churches trying to adopt kind of anti-racism as a project, because white lower middle-class Americans know what that language that language now means. You're bad people, regardless of your actual views. And so it's become so perverse and toxic. And so I think I think the future is shoulder to shoulder, not face to face, which is that we've got to figure out what we want to do together to achieve certain goals, together, and then we'll work to those goals. And that's how community is built and trust is built. Schools would be a good place to start, having decent schools
Getting the homicide rate down in Baltimore would be a good place to start, too.
That's unfortunately all the time we have. Let's thank our speakers.